Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the Damcasters, brought to you in association with the Pima Air and Space Museum. I'm your host, Matt Bowen. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Damcasters. And this week, we're doing something slightly different in that you don't hear much from me. So I can hear the listening statistics going straight through the roof. But you will be hearing a lot from the CEO of the Pima Air and Space Museum, Scott Marchand, and the Director of Collections, Andrew Bailey. We'll get that right eventually. And they're going to be discussing an interesting phenomenon. Now, aircraft that are on display in museums tend to have stories based around them, and it's either because that aircraft did something significant or fought through, I don't know, the Battle of Britain or something. Now, at a museum like the Imperial War Museum, Duxford, they have a rule that the aircraft that are on display have to be painted up in the way in which they were operated. Which gets interesting when you have restoration slash rebuild slash new build aircraft, such as the Mark I Spitfire, which doesn't have a hell of a lot of original metal in it. So what happens when you have an aircraft that's an amalgam of different things? A Frankenplane, if you will. Their word, not mine. Hence the name of the episode. I quite liked it, so we're running with it. So what goes into deciding how to represent that aircraft? Now, within an overall collection such as Pima has, you're going to want to fill some of the gaps and tell some specific stories, especially for local Arizona residents who have had fascinating careers. So for the next little while, we're going to talk about four aircraft in the Pima collection. That is their Bristol Bolingbroke, their P-40, their P-51, and their B-24, which does have an interesting history, but has some interesting paint on it. Scott and Andy are going to explain all, delve into the stories behind the paint schemes and the aircraft and how they came to be at Pima. Now, eagle-eared listeners, if that is actually a thing, well, I've noticed there hasn't been an ad for 909 apparel. And that is because we're going to do it right now. Tom over at 909 is great. He's one of our Damcasters over on Patreon too, which is very kind of him. And they have a new range of t-shirts out, which they've done in collaboration with the 100th Bomb Group Foundation. And it is their Century Bombers series. So it's based upon one of the logos that was on an A2. And they are fantastic. All the money goes to supporting the 100th Bomb Group Foundation, which is working to preserving and disseminating the first-hand accounts of the men, missions, and machines of the 100th Bomb Group that fought in the skies over Europe. So do check that out via the link in the description below. 50% of all the proceeds go to supporting the foundation, and they are really cool t-shirts. So do give them a look and, yeah, get your aviation on and support the 100th Bomb Group Foundation, which is doing great work there. So, without further ado, we head back to the Pima Air and Space Museum. And if you like what you hear, check out the YouTube channel. because each of these little segments is going to become their own little video with very shaky camera work by me. There was some technical issues. I couldn't fix them all. One more thing to add. Dear Andy had a coughing fit in the middle of us talking about the fabulous Hawker Hurricane they have there. I couldn't figure out how to turn his mic off and still film Scott. Scott was determined to keep going. So we did. So there's a bit of coughing. Sorry about that. I couldn't fix it. Please bear with us throughout, and I hope it doesn't distract. Anyways, over to Scott and Andy and the Bolingbroke.
So curatorially, we're often charged with making some interesting decisions about how we want to represent our artifacts. Generally speaking, as Andrew's touched upon in other episodes, is when we have a known history of an airframe, we will generally pick a history from that portfolio, right? But occasionally we will get aircraft here that are really Franken airplanes, or they're constituted out of new parts, refabricated parts. So in that case, when we don't really have a clean, clear, concise history, I mean, look, you could pick the history of an aileron and build a story around it too, right? I don't know that we've done that, but what we've typically done is we've done things like with the Bolingbroke behind us. This came from Dave Talashe's collection, and he had it in the yard at Chino after rescuing it from the Western Canada Manitoba in the early 70s. Dave harvested many, many airplanes over the years, and his intention was always to fly things. So in the context of putting this airplane back together, they took all the best components and pieces to put together into a flyable aircraft, which means the aircraft behind us is constituted out of the bits and pieces of at least five different Bolingbrokes that we've been able to identify when we took it apart and brought it back here. So now most of your listeners know the Bolingbrokes in RCAF service were largely relegated to training detail and were all painted, you know, various shades of yellow or yellow and black. And there's a lot of them interpreted in that way, and we took the decision that we were going to do something a little bit different and, you know, tell some of the lesser known stories of World War II. The Canadian Air Force operated many Bolingbrokes on the west coast of Canada, out of British Columbia, on anti-submarine, anti-shipping patrols, surveillance patrols, as well as the training duties. So after looking around, we picked this paint scheme, which represents Bolingbroke 9118, which was an operational aircraft on the east coast of Canada with 115 Squadron at Annette Island in Alaska. What was kind of fun about this story is some evidence surfaced in the early 2000s that 9118 had conducted a submarine attack on what they thought was a Japanese submarine, and turns out with further historical research, not done by us, but by smarter people, determined that in all likelihood, they sunk a Russian submarine or possibly a whale. So, you know, it's kind of a colorful story of a fairly quiet theater of the war, and it just allows us to broaden our reach and ties the aircraft into our Pacific theme hangar display. So another important airplane that we're fortunate here to have in the collection is our Curtiss P-40E Warhawk. Now, this is painted up as serial number 41-25163, and its nose art, aptly represented here for our context, is Arizona. So I'll let Andrew talk about why it's painted this way.
Right. So this is another one of those Franken airplanes that came from lots of new build parts and parts that Rob Greinert and previous owners of this aircraft have gotten from places all over North America and Australia and
Alaska,
yeah. South Pacific, all of the above. So it's another aircraft that has no real identifiable history. So this is, again, where we get to talk about an interesting story. So this aircraft is a surprisingly well-documented aircraft from the very early stages of World War II in the Pacific. It was an aircraft that was due to head to the Royal Australian Air Force and ended up going into American service, like a lot of aircraft at that point, because everyone was just kind of grabbing what was available. So Sidney S. Woods was assigned this aircraft and chose the name Arizona because he was from Arizona. He played football for the University of Arizona, and he had this art commissioned with this rattlesnake on it. Now, some people will notice that we have the same thing on both sides, but there's photos showing on the other side a rattlesnake that seems less complete and doesn't have Arizona on it. But when you look at the photos, you can see the cans of paint on the ground on the other side. So it's quite clear that that artist was going back and forth using the paints to do the different colors simultaneously. So models and other recreations of this aircraft have always kind of showed it with two different types of snakes and only Arizona on one side. We, after looking at these photos, made
the determination that that was incorrect.
Right.
You know, Sidney Woods had come out to check on the progress of the nose art that was going on his airplane, that he'd probably parted with several bottles of premium booze for a talented ground crewman to represent. When we did do the airplane, my wife fortunately has artistic talent. She recreated the nose art for us. And just talking to her about the technique and the economy of working around doing this type of nose art, she says, yeah, you've mixed your paint, you've done your sketches, you are going to work. It's not hard to work both sides simultaneously. So it really kind of confirmed our suspicion that, you know, you have to be careful about interpreting photographic evidence, because all it tells you is what's happening at that specific point in time. It doesn't tell you before or after. So you kind of have to apply a little bit of, you know, a bit of reasoning to your interpretation sometimes. You know, Andy had talked about, you know, Sidney Woods' connection to Tucson. You know, he was very prominent in the area for many, many years after the war. He was a regent at the University of Arizona. He later went on and flew in Northwest Europe, and I believe he was an ace in a day, too.
Right. He shot down, I believe, two Bettys and either a Zero in the Pacific, flying P-40s and P-38s. Then he did a tour in Europe with a P-38 unit, and then went back and did a tour as a squadron commander with the P-51 unit, shot down five FW-190s in one day, and then got shot down and spent the last couple months of the war as a POW, which was also a very hairy time for POWs, as, you know, they were being forced marched and everything. But yeah, as Scott pointed out, he came back to Arizona, was prominent in, you know, political circles and if I recall
agriculture.
Quickly, yeah, he owned a ranch and farm out in Yuma.
Yeah, and he died of cancer in the 1980s. And, you know, he's really kind of unknown in our community and in the aviation community at large because, you know, I guess he didn't live long enough to do the air show circuit and the autograph circuit. So we thought it was really appropriate for us to acknowledge his service and perpetuate his memory in our collection. So many, many years ago when I started working here, a conspicuous absence in our collection was a P-51 Mustang. You know, our organization's collection has grown opportunistically over the years, and we haven't always had a large budget. And, you know, the World War II fighters are always in high demand with people with greater resources than most museums. So we had an opportunity in the early 2000s to acquire the basics of a P-51 Mustang restoration project, which ultimately became the airplane behind us here. We fabricated a lot of parts and pieces here. I bought a lot of new build stuff from Warbird suppliers. We traded for non-flyable material. So it's probably about 50% original parts and components from many, many different aircraft. And everything that we weren't able to buy or acquire, we fabricated here. So again, we were left with this conundrum. Well, how do we represent it? The 8th Air Force and the 9th Air Force is disproportionately represented in the Mustang community. So being slightly contrarian in nature here, we thought, well, what can we do to, you know, play to our strengths? And one of the strengths we have here is our extensive Pacific Theater collection from World War II, the vast majority of which these aircraft all have operational service. So We were looking around for an interesting story to tell that hadn't been picked up before, and it didn't take us long to come across the story of Lieutenant Lou Curtis. And I'll let Andrew talk about Lou's career.
So he's, again, another one of those interesting guys. So you look at the scorecard on the side of the airplane. I mean, you'll notice German, Italian, and Japanese. We'll save the obvious at the end. But so he flew in the Mediterranean for at least one tour, I believe, flying P-38s. And he actually even got shot down, became a POW, but was either escaped.
He escaped from the camp.
He escaped from the camp, right.
Yeah. Which is why he got sent to the Pacific.
Right. Because once you get shot down in a theater, you're usually not allowed to, you know,
if you fly again.
Right. Because you don't want to torture, giving away who helped you escape, all that kind of stuff. So he ended up in the Pacific, and he ended up in the 3rd Air Commando Group, which in of itself is interesting. It was an interesting composite group, usually of a fighter squadron, a B-25 squadron, and an Elbert squadron. And the ideas were that they were going to be forward deployed, helping troops and often commando units and stuff. Like, you know, in the there was one in India as well that was kind of dealing with the India-Burma and Merrill's Marauders. So how did he end up with an official American kill? Well, one day he was out in his flight flying and saw a C-47 that was landing in Bataan Island near the Philippines, which at that point had not been liberated by the Allies or the Americans.
Yeah, the C-47 crew was actually off course. They thought they were a little bit further south.
Right.
They had to lined up on a very similar-looking island.
Right, and he recognized, well, if they land on a Japanese-held island, it's not going to go well for them. So he tried to get, you know, their attention, but, you know, it's not like the movies. Everyone's radio sets did not communicate with each other. So he's, you know, waggling his wings, doing all this stuff, and they are just
buzzing the C-47. They're giving him the finger.
Right. They're just
ignoring him.
So the only option he had was, well, what if I damage their engines enough that they end up having to ditch in the water? And that's exactly what he did. He very surgically shot up some of the engines, and the aircraft ditched. He remained on cap for a while until, like, Dumbo showed up in Air Sea Rescue and got all of them out. And it turned out that it was actually medical staff. It was doctors and nurses, which would have been, you know,
even doubly disastrous.
Double disasters.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, so, yeah. And he officially was awarded an American kill. But Scott was going to point out another thing that was interesting. We painted this aircraft and all
the model kits and
everything,
all the books.
Yep, had a yellow spinner on it. So, of course, we do that. And kid you not, about a month later on
Critical Pass,
who's been digitizing all the National Archives, says, shows Curtis in his P-51 with a red spinner. Luckily, it was easy enough to just take the spinner off and repaint it.
Because it was a color film that they had
shot.
Yes, right?
Yes. And the other thing, too, is, and you know, that was not common because this group is notoriously hard to document. You look in these really detailed books on 5th Air Force and Pacific units, this one, it's all over the place. You know, they're not really sure if the colors on the spinners represented flights within the squadron or what. So, but luckily, again, it was just a spinner. We had to pop it off, repaint it, not have to take the aircraft back and repaint the whole thing.
And his ultimate victory of the war, it turns out one of the nurses on the aircraft later became his girlfriend and wife, and she died about 10 years ago. We got to speak with her briefly before for her passing away.
We're going to take a quick break to pop to the Pima Air and Space Museum to visit with Director of Collections Andrew Bailey and find out about one of the aircraft in the incredible Pima collection.
Here we are at the Pima Air and Space Museum with one of our two Sikorsky Dragonflies. The Dragonfly was one of the first helicopters to go into service with the U.S. military, the Air Force, the Marines, and the Navy use them. This one was used by the Coast Guard. It was the first helicopter used by the Coast Guard. They were heavily used to kind of set up doctrine for search and rescue for the Coast Guard. So a lot of what went forward with more modern and powerful helicopters after this was all stuff that they learned using the Dragonfly. This one did do a stint on one of the Coast Guard icebreakers because they usually had helicopter support with those. It's interesting to take a look at these earlier helicopters that used World War II style piston engines. Like this one had a Pratt & Whitney R-98. So it limited a lot of the payload these types of helicopters could take. So it really was until you started having turbine engines in helicopters, like starting with helicopters like the Huey, that helicopters were actually able to start carrying larger amounts of troops and carry more equipment and more crew, weapons, etc. But this is one of the ones that started it all, like with the Bell and some of the other early helicopter designs.
To learn more about what is on display and what events are coming up at the Pima Air and Space Museum in Tucson, Arizona, please do check out their website at www.pimaair.org.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
And now, back to the show.
So continuing on with our look into some of our representative World War II paint schemes at our museum, behind me is our Hawker Hurricane, which is in Mark II configuration. Although the cockpit and wing center section are Canadian Car and Foundry Mark 12, which means it was built in Canada, largely flown in Canada with training squadrons and home defense. It was recovered from a lake in Quebec in the 80s, passed around several different restoration shops until it was put together as a static display in Texas in the 1990s. Through a series of different transactions, we came into possession of the airplane about 20 years ago. And left it in the paint scheme that it came in, which was another fictionalized paint scheme representing Stanford Tuck, another famous RAF ace. However, I decided to exert a little bit of executive privilege here. Over the course of my research and interest in the Royal Air Force, I came to know many World War II veterans up in Canada when I lived there, and one guy in particular, a fellow named Rex Probert, was a Hurricane and Spitfire pilot in the Mediterranean in 42 and 43, and he served in 33 Squadron in the spring of 1942, and he introduced me to L.C. Wade. Now, L.C. Wade is distinguished as being the highest scoring non-Commonwealth pilot to ever serve in the RAF. He's credited with 25 victories, 22 kills, one shared, three damaged. He had a further ground kill, five more ground damaged, and 13 more probables. Rex and one of his other friends, who was also on the squadron, Milt Josie with Wade, said that score is probably modest. It's probably exceeds 50 because LC had a tendency to take new pilots up and give them a baptism of fire and sort of sneak in behind them and shoot down an airplane and give them credit. So I think his true tally is much higher than credited, very similar to someone like Pat Paddle. Now, why L.C. Wade and why the PMR and Space Museum? Well, so one thing that Rex Probert shared with me is that on the squadron, L.C. always referred to Tucson as his hometown. Although he was born in Brotus, Texas, and raised in Reclaw, Texas, Wade had come to Tucson in particular in 1934, sort of the onset of the Depression, and he was just chasing work. He ended up enlisting the Civilian Conservation Corps out here, which was a public works program, putting young men to work for a fairly decent wage at the time, which was about $1 a day, doing public works construction in various communities around the country. Okay. So LC spent 6 years here doing various things. He enrolled at the University of Arizona but never graduated. He also learned to fly here. He spent time working with a crop dusting firm in the region, built up his hours, and in December 1940, like many other Americans, close to 8,400 Americans enlisted in the RAF during the Second World War. LC was one of them. He enlisted here in Tucson and did his refresher training at the Spartan School of Aeronautics in Oklahoma, and went to England, completed OTU there, converted to fighters, and then was sent to the Middle East, flew a Hurricane off of, I think the Eagle, HMS Eagle, reinforcing Malta. But he only spent a short amount of time in Malta before being sent to Egypt as a reinforcement pilot to 33 Squadron, which was shortly going to be in the thick of it, in Tobruk, El Alamein, and all the intense battles in the Western Desert in the summer of 1942. I had the opportunity before he passed away to speak to LC's older brother, Orem, in Texas, and got a lot of family background. One thing is perpetuated in all the histories is he's always referred to as Lance Cleo. He never actually had proper first names. He was always LC in the family, and he was forced to pick proper Christian names when he enlisted in the RAF, and Lance Cleo was the result. So he was only ever known as LC, and that's what the pilots that served with him always knew him as. He spoke very affectionately about Tucson. He intended to be back here after the war and continue an aviation career and finish his studies. That, unfortunately, was cut short. He was killed in a shipwreck crash in Foggia, Italy, in the summer of 1944. His remains were treated after the war by his family, and he's interred in Cushing, Texas, in the family plot. So it's a nice fitting tribute, and also connects into our local community and some of the rich aviation history we have here in Arizona. So one of the crown jewels of our collection, and has been for even before we were even open to the public, is our Star of India, the B-24J Liberator. And I'll let Angie give you a little bit of the background on its service before it came into our hands.
Right. So this was one of the aircraft that were sent to the Royal Air Force and used, well, supposed to be used as essentially maritime patrol. It would not have had the ball turret in it. It would have had the search radar for anti-shipping and anti-submarine patrols. As far as we can tell, it never actually got assigned to an RAF squadron when it was over there. It probably went to a replacement depot, or if it did get assigned to squadrons, the paperwork never got caught up with it, because we've been told that it was assigned to a couple squadrons, but we've gotten the records for both those squadrons, and it doesn't show up in anything.
No, and people smarter than us on this airplane have researched for 40 years trying to establish its history and have come up empty. So the best we can do is pick it up where it left off after the war.
Right.
And it was one of the better airframes that was left behind in India and continued on its maritime reconnaissance with the RAF until the fall of the Raj, when the English abandoned India. 18 of these aircraft were left behind. They were gently demilitarized by having their wheels retracted and set on trestles at Pune Airfield and walked away from. Shortly thereafter, the newly formed Indian Air Force rolled in, picked the airplanes up, put them on their gear, repainted the rondelles and markings on them, and put them into service for another 20 years.
Right, and then they got, it was 1968, they started retiring them, replacing them with Russian Bears. And we, as a fledgling museum that wasn't even a museum yet, was just a handful of aircraft over at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base and with the board of directors.
The Indian Air Force sent out a call around the world saying, hey,
oh, okay,
we have these aircraft that are retiring. Anybody who wants one, they're free to be taken, but you got to get over here and get them out of here, you know, fairly efficiently. So Rhodes Arnold, who was one of our founding energy sources here, sent a letter expressing our interest. We were granted permission, and he sent a delegation over, and they picked the best of the lot, and then set about amassing the resources to get it back here.
Right.
They ended up getting the fuel sponsored by Union 76, and there were several reserve pilots across the street in Davis-Monthan Air Force Base who had actually been Liberator crew during the war, who volunteered to do the ferry flight.
Right. So, yeah, they picked it up, and this was before any of the other major museums picked up any of these. So they got their volunteer crew. Rhodes Arnold went out for part of the flight, and they started heading west, so which required them to, well, fly near and or over Pakistan, which apparently the story goes, a couple of Pakistani F-86 Sabres intercepted the aircraft, wondering why there was an Indian maritime bomber flying over their space.
Yeah, so they actually started a gun pass and probably would have been shot down Had the American crew not put two giant American flags on the vertical stabilizers on each side of the airplane while leaving the Indian markings on it. So the crew were instructed to land. They landed in Karachi, and after several days of diplomatic negotiations and discussions, they were cleared to depart for the rest of their leg in their flight and were escorted out of Pakistan by the same Pakistani sabers that intercepted them. After several more legs hopping across Europe and over the North Atlantic through Gander, Newfoundland, it ended up here in Tucson in the summer of 1969 and was greeted by Jimmy Doolittle and many other local dignitaries.
Right, and its last stop before coming here was Dallas-Fort Worth at the same factory that built this aircraft.
Yep.
And so, yeah, it was one of the earliest aircraft that we acquired. And we talked a little bit about Rhodes Arnold. He really was one of the driving forces behind the collection of this museum collection in its early stages. Before him, really everything that was in the collection was mostly Air Force and Navy loan artifacts. He got us the BT-13 from the University of Arizona.
Yep.
Or not, I'm sorry, Tucson High, because yep. It was a technical aircraft for their training school.
Yep.
And, you know, he was the one who really started amassing a movement to get more aircraft for this collection. So,
and he wasn't discriminating. His ethos, and actually, you know, the board and the organization at the time recognized that there was a lot of rich aviation history. I mean, it was the 1960s and early 70s. I mean, aviation, you know, Wright Brothers, 1903. So a lot had happened, and they were very conscious of this, and they made an expressed effort to not have us be purely a military-themed organization and sought out commercial, civil, and experimental aircraft as best they could with the resources that they had. So the poor old B-24 sat outside here for many, many years with its plexiglass yellowing, but still loved. In the mid-1980s, as the World War II veterans groups were reaching retirement age and had affluence and interest, you know, we got introduced to several different associations, and the 446 Bomb Group partnered with our organization in the late 1980s to help fundraise for the building that's here. So their condition of the fundraising is that one side of our B-24 be painted in 446 Bomb Group colors. Again, which is slightly fictional, and I'll let Andrew talk about the nose art.
So that's the interesting thing about this nose art is this is supposed to represent an aircraft that was the lead aircraft on D-Day, and that's what that 6 bomb marker is up there.
Yeah.
And I believe they were the lead group for the 8th Air Force, so it would have been one of the first aircraft going over that morning.
Yeah.
Well, the thing
in daylight.
Well, yes, in daylight. Thank you, Scott.
Yeah.
Can't forget about Commonwealth.
Yeah. Now, its original nose art name was
Red Ass.
Yeah.
And that was what the donkey was. But apparently, they did not want to report Red Ass in the newspaper articles and stuff like that. So Bungay Buckaroo was actually the nickname of the unit's mascot. At their base, they had this huge, like, mural of a cowboy on a horse, like, out in the southwest somewhere, and he was called the Bungay Buckaroo because Bungay was their home station. So I don't think there was ever actually a flying Bungay Buckaroo. It was Red Ass, and it was only Red Ass. But I think for the guys, too, they wanted to have something that kind of
represented everybody, and not just
exactly.
One crew.
Yes, exactly. So you get in a lot of interesting things when it comes to paint schemes in a museum sometimes, because it's not all as straightforward as one thinks.
Yeah. But on the starboard side of the aircraft, we preserved it in Indian Air Force 6 Squadron markings as it arrived. The airplane is as it arrived. It had its complete military configuration. Everything that went into the factory in Fort Worth that the RAF used, that the Indian Air Force used, is still here. And as Andrew touched on before, the only exception is the ball turret, which was installed to have it representative of the 446 and more broadly representative of Liberator combat configuration versus the H-2S radar that it was originally configured with. So it is our, again, it's one of our pride and joys. It's a very, very rare aircraft. I think there's, something like a half a dozen B-24Js in the world.
Give or take maybe a couple more. I mean, just from the ones from India alone, you have the Canadian one, you have the Royal Air Force Museum, you have ours,
Collins Foundation.
You have Collins Foundation, and you have the former Talishay, now Kermit Weeks. So five,
I think
there's one in India still.
Yep.
And then there's a few other.
The Air Force Museum has, there's several in the.
The other ones that are around were not, but there's one at the Air Force Museum, one at Barksdale, one at Imperial War Museum.
So we can round it up a little bit,
yeah,
but there we go. So anyway, but we are very fortunate to have a very unique and diverse representation of World War II Allied and Axis aircraft presented in our collection.
It was a lot of fun filming those segments at the Pima Air and Space Museum, which you should definitely check out if you're ever in Tucson. They are laying the foundations at the moment for the Military Vehicle Museum. That's coming along at a great pace. The amount of stuff they have there is just... Yeah, I've been home for a few weeks now, and I'm still boggled by how much it was. You know, I was there for 5 days, and I spent this amount of an episode inside the hangars. The rest of the time, I was outside trying to get through all the stuff I didn't see last time. It's nuts, in a good way. So check them out, pimaair.org. Please give 909 Apparel and their new 100 Bomb Group Foundation collaboration a look as well. Links in the description below for that. And I always have to say at the end of these pods, thank you so much for your support. It's been great. Everybody's been super kind as well. If you can pop some stars into your podcast app of choice, leave a review. You don't even have to leave a review. Just tell me what your favorite aircraft is or a subject you'd like me to cover. All of this stuff comes through. It all helps the algorithms. And the algorithms, if they're listening, we welcome our algorithmic overlords, do help this thing move up and down in the charts, which is always great. If you fancy being a bit more of a direct support with your £3 a month, become a Damcasteer. I just sent out the latest batch of packages with thank you cards and bookmarks and stickers and things. And if you'd like to try to decipher my hieroglyphic handwriting, check that out. patreon.com/thedamcasters. You get all these things early, different intro, outros, teasers for what's coming up. And you get this video all in one bit, which is quite nice. I'm not in it, so I suppose that's a bonus. Until next week, I'm not sure what we're going to be doing next week. I'm editing 2 videos at the moment, but keep an eye on our socials. Thank you all for your incredible support. Until next time, do take care of yourselves. Bye-bye.
The Damcasters is hosted and produced by Matt Bone and is a Boney Abroad podcast production. To learn more about our podcast and check out our previous episodes, head to www.thedamcasterspod.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.